This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Good to be with you.
Well, it was like something out of a James Bond movie, a fighter jet being deployed to ground a commercial airliner mid-flight so a government could nab a dissident. And it happened this past Sunday in Eastern Europe. To learn the details and what they mean, we'll go to Richard.
Yes, I mean, imagine you've got a flight going from, say, Florida to California. For some reason, this flight takes cuts briefly through Mexican territory. And while doing that, a Mexican fighter jet claims that there's a bomb threat and forces the plane to the ground, takes off a political prisoner before letting it continue on its way. There would be absolute outrage within the United States if one of its aircraft had been treated in that way. And I think there would be a pretty forceful response from the United States if that was the case. But this is essentially what you had in Eastern Europe this week. You had a Ryanair plane, so a plane run by a company based in the European Union. The flight went from Greece to Lithuania, from one EU country to another EU country. But on the way here, it went over Belarus. And while in Belarusian airspace, Belarus sent up a fighter jet. They said that they claimed that there was a bomb from Hamas on the plane. They said, you know, land or we'll shoot you down. The plane landed. They came in there. They detained an anti-government activist and his girlfriend. And afterwards, they released pictures of this individual. It looks like he has been tortured after being grabbed from this flight like that. And then, you know, the flight was allowed to continue once this political prisoner had been taken off. So really a remarkable development from Eastern Europe.
And just tell us more about how they justified doing this, why they are so concerned about this particular individual.
Well, I think if you think back over the last few months of news from Belarus, they're in the midst of a disputed election. The leader of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, he's sometimes called Europe's last dictator because he still is a dictator. And in the wake of this kind of disputed election, there have been some big protests. So this individual that they took off, he was arrested or was accused of organizing mass protests. He faces up to 15 years in prison. And they really are kind of cracking down on any kind of dissidents that they can. He has ties, I think, to one of the last independent bits of media. He was a co-founder and former editor of NEXTA, one of the last bits of independent media in Belarus that is obviously critical of the government. So it's about silencing any opposition and silencing any actual journalism.
And you mentioned Europe really reacting strongly against this. We've been tracking the relationship between Europe and Russia for quite some time. Explain why it really points back to Russia, what has happened here, and why Europe would be so concerned about that.
Well, there's definitely an outcry from the European public. And I think what this whole thing has done is expose just how pathetic the EU is in quite a lot of ways. I mean, the response has been tepid. They have banned Belarusian planes from coming into European airspace. They've banned European planes from flying over Belarus. Some of these measures are actually going to cost the EU and EU airlines more money than they cost Belarus. I mean, they're not nothing. I don't want to minimize them too much. They are fairly substantial. At the same time, you compare it to what the US would have done if someone had done this to America. And then they do start to look quite small. So it's got a lot of people within Europe saying, okay, well, sanctions are well enough, but we do need more muscle. We need bigger muscle. We need to act in a way that other people respect us. You know, it was just a few months ago where we were talking on this show about the way that the Russian foreign minister just completely disrespected the EU's equivalent of a foreign minister. It's really getting a lot of people thinking, fine, okay, we are an economic power. There are some pretty impressive things that we can do with sanctions, and we are doing some of those things, but that's not enough. At the end of the day, if you want respect, if you want people to treat you well, if you want your airplanes not to be hijacked, you need to have more of a muscular approach. And so I think that's going to be the kind of the long-term effect of this is, yes, there'll be responses, but I think it's also going to prompt European leaders to think, well, what can we do so that we're not in this position again? Or the next time Belarus pokes us, how can we be in a position where we can actually hit back? And you mentioned Belarus's connection with Russia. I think that's another very interesting connection here. Obviously, Lukashenko is only able to stay in power because of Vladimir Putin, and Russia is really kind of, people weren't sure how Putin would respond. Would he kind of distance himself from this act of air piracy? And in fact, he's done the opposite, where he has really stood up and backed Lukashenko pretty strongly. And he's banned European flights from over Russian territory. He kind of, or those that would have formally bypassed Belarus, he's saying, well, you can't get around Belarus by coming into Russia. So he's kind of hit, once Europe hit Belarus, he hit back. And so it's really kind of given Europe the impression that, okay, well, Lukashenko might have been the one immediately there, but Putin is the one behind this. So this is pushing Belarus closer to Putin, as you've got these sanctions between Russia or Europe and Belarus. They're kind of pushed closer to their big protector. Euro Intelligence, by the veteran German journalist Wolfgang Munschau, they wrote, we've been reporting about the possibility of a Russia-Belarus political union, not a power grab, but a gradual process. The hijacking of the Ryanair plane has the potential to accelerate this process. So this has got this potential to push Belarus much closer to Russia. At the same time, this has the potential to prompt Europe to become much stronger as they see, well, we've got to stand up to not just Belarus, but Russia as well.
Our editor-in-chief has talked about how Russia's actions really will be a major catalyst to greater unification within Europe. And this very well could be what happens, what follows on from this event.
Absolutely. And this is not just one event. This is a major kind of milestone in a whole series of patterns. And we are seeing Europe kind of come together in this way. Mr. Flory has a book, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, where this book really focuses on Vladimir Putin and the role Vladimir Putin plays in Bible prophecy. But in that book, it does talk quite a lot about Europe. I've got the search open now. There's 27 different mentions of it. And it talks a lot about, you know, the pivotal role that this individual plays in end time prophecy. The Bible talks about somebody that is the Prince of Rosh that would play a pivotal role. And he talks about how a lot of that role will come from agitating Europe, from providing an impetus for Europe to unite. He was writing this. You could think back to when Russia was invading Ukraine. You can go back 15 years or more and see, or nearly 15 years, see Mr. Flory making this same point. So it's interesting that this is something that is prompting Europe to unite, and also something that then connects pretty quickly back to Vladimir Putin. We're seeing him play this role once again of prodding Europe to come together in that way that the Bible says that they will.
Well, we have an article up on the website right now by Mihailo Zekic, Belarus hijacks plane, kidnaps journalist. And it points to these statements that Gerald Flory has made for some years about Russian actions catalyzing European unification. Go check out that article. We'll link to it in our show notes. And it also points to the booklet that Gerald Flory wrote, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. Thank you very much, Richard. The United States is putting serious pressure on Israel, as evidenced by a visit this week from President Joe Biden's Secretary of State. To learn about this, we'll go to our Jerusalem correspondent, Brent Noctegal.
Yes, Antony Blinken was in town on Tuesday and Wednesday with a number of other American diplomats, and he met with the Prime Minister, the Foreign Minister of Israel, Defense Minister, and also met with Palestinian officials, including Mahmoud Abbas. He came here for three purposes, it seems, or at least he came with three points of contact with Israel that he wanted to discuss. One of those being what they're going to do about the Gaza situation following the war between Hamas and Israel. And the United States is looking to fund a lot of the reconstruction efforts inside Gaza along with others. And they're trying to figure out a way to try and get money into Gaza that will go directly to reconstruction and not to Hamas, which is very difficult to do, obviously, because Hamas does hold that whole territory to ransom with its 30,000 soldiers. And so it's very hard to do that. We'll see how that goes forward. Another couple of items on the agenda was to announce that the America is seeking to open up a consulate for the Palestinians inside Jerusalem. And then the third item was to discuss the reasons for the uptick in violence that precipitated the Gaza war. And there were a couple of things that he discussed that he wants Israel to make sure doesn't get out of hand. One of those was to make sure that the Temple Mount does not become a flashpoint. I don't know how, again, Israel stops that from happening, given that was instigated by the Palestinians, the violence against Israeli forces, which forced them to come onto the Temple Mount. But interestingly enough, he did also mention the pending evictions of Palestinian families living in East Jerusalem and Sheikh Jarrah, which we've talked about in this program, which is a case that's pending before the Supreme Court. It looks like an open and shut case based on Israeli law that they should go since they're unpaying tenants. However, he basically said that in comments to Axios, he raised the evictions of Palestinians from their homes where they've lived for decades and generations. And he doesn't like the demolishing of the houses as well that takes place after a terrorist attack. Then the family's home of that terrorist is demolished by Israel. That's got to stop as well. And so there's a lot of pressure on Israel. He's basically saying these are the things that led to the war. Your evictions of East Jerusalem homes of Palestinians in East Jerusalem is one of them. Make sure it doesn't happen. And this case, it looks like the Supreme Court has asked the Attorney General to rule on it, or at least give his opinion on it by June 8th. So this isn't going away. This will be in the news for the next couple of weeks at least. But it shows the American position again is to, which we've drawn attention to, which is to sustain the oppression of international consensus that East Jerusalem belongs to the Arabs. Even if the Israeli law says they shouldn't be there, well, it's theirs. We believe that these Arabs deserve to be there. And even this final point about this opening of a separate consulate mission or consulate inside Jerusalem for the Palestinians is a really, really big move. This is a move that Israel is going to have to sign off on. The Israeli government, Mr. Netanyahu, said he does not favor this at all. And for every reason that you would understand why is there a need for a Palestinian consulate in Jerusalem when there's already an embassy of the United States in Jerusalem. That embassy, I've been there many times. There's more Palestinians than Israelis, more Palestinians than Jews, I should say, that are visiting that embassy to get visas to come to the United States. It services Arabs and Jews. Why do we need a separate mission? And Ambassador Friedman, the former ambassador, Trump's ambassador, he basically said that the desire to open a separate consulate inside Jerusalem just for Palestinians is tantamount to changing the United States Congress law, Jerusalem Act, that says that the city of Jerusalem is undivided under Israeli sovereignty. You're opening up a consulate. Consulates to belong to nations. The United States does not recognize Palestine as a nation, and it does not recognize East Jerusalem as the capital of the Palestinian state. And yet, Blinken, of course, always knows this, and he says, we're not saying East Jerusalem is the capital of Palestine, but we want to open up a separate mission so that we can talk to the Palestinians without them having to go to the embassy, which is pushing and nudging the American position towards this idea that East Jerusalem is going to be the future capital of a Palestinian state, and we're going to lay the groundwork for that, opening this or desiring to open a separate consulate from their embassy in Jerusalem.
We have known that the Biden administration is far less a friend of Israel than the Trump administration. What's your sense, Brent, of what we're hearing from the Secretary of State here? Is this worse than what was expected. Obviously, we knew that these kinds of moves were coming, and the Biden administration has been signaling this kind of support for the Palestinians in many ways. What's your sense?
I think that did we sense that this was coming? Yes, just because we understood that even if Joe Biden, I would say Mr. Biden, has been a longstanding friend of Israel and vocally supportive of Israel for a long time, and supportive of Israel's security, his whole team on the ground here and in the State Department, or a lot of the majority of them are from Obama's cabinet and Obama's people. And so that is the continued thrust, regardless of him. And a lot of people are saying, well, look at Joe Biden. He's speaking about Israel's right to defend themselves, and that's wonderful. And I'm like, well, that is, but look at the policies on the ground. And so I think what is worrying for Israelis is you see the demands that Hamas has on Israel to not continue fighting against Israel, and they look exactly the same as the U.S. demands on Israel as well. Israel, the Biden administration now is closer to Hamas's position. Yes, the Biden administration is not going to say it warrants rockets attacks against Israel. However, they agree with Hamas's positions in the Temple Mount, with these evictions, and now with opening a separate consulate for the Palestinians inside Jerusalem, breaking, it seems, U.S. law through it. I think that's a huge wake-up call to many Israelis. I think the prime minister is aware of it. I think the fact that Israel has to sign off it means that it is going to be a sticking point between the United States and Israel. And as I think we talked about last week, we do expect a huge fracturing that we've never seen before, even in the Obama years, a fracturing of this relationship between the United States and Israel to take place. And the fact that that fracture is going to be over East Jerusalem, again, is very significant prophetically. Our editor-in-chief has written a book on Zechariah, and the very last chapter in that book, I really do suggest people read it. The chapter is entitled Jerusalem Violence Triggers Christ's Return. That's why we cover this, not necessarily because of the breaking of this relationship between the United States and Israel, although that is prophesied also. It's the fact that the process of transferring East Jerusalem sovereignty from Israeli governance to Palestinian rule is going to happen. That's what the Bible says in Zechariah 12 and verse 2. And that precipitates a series of events that leads to Jesus Christ's return. And so to see the United States pushing that exact policy right now, agreeing with Hamas in that policy as well, maybe not the means to get there, however, the policy is the same, you can see how the United States is pushing towards that prophecy being fulfilled.
All right, Jerusalem Violence Triggers Christ's Return, the chapter of Jerusalem in Prophecy, we'll link to in our show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Japan has decided to drastically boost its defense budget. To learn why, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party released a draft white paper on Monday, and they are calling for drastic increases in the nation's defense spending and defense-related research and development. So this effort was led by Japanese Defense Minister Nobuo Kishi. He's the younger brother of the former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, and like Abe, Kishi is determined to normalize Japan's military and to just shed whatever remains of the kind of that facade of pacifism that was imposed on Japan by the United States at the end of World War II. So Kishi is dedicated to making that happen, and the new prime minister, Yoshihide Suga, is also on the same page. And the big headline for this specific proposal is that Japan will no longer cap its defense spending at 1% of gross domestic product. This was never a formal limit on the spending, but it has served as an unofficial ceiling on spending. But now that's gone. We don't yet know how high they intend to set it. But Kishi said in an interview this week, quote, "We must increase our defense capabilities at a radically different pace than in the past." And he spoke about busting through that 1% cap specifically. And the recommendations that he put forth especially emphasize the need for Japan to focus more on the development of next-generation warplanes. So, you know, a class of armaments there that's very lethal but also very costly to develop. But this is a trend that we've seen in Japan for a number of years, just with steady and gradual increases in military spending. And this year actually marks the ninth consecutive increase in the budget there. But with this latest increase by Kishi and the LDP, we don't yet have hard numbers, as I said, but it looks like it'll be considerably more drastic than what we've seen over the past 9 years with those steady ramping up figures.
Maybe you could just put this in the larger historical context. Japan has been improving its military capability over a period of decades after it was specifically limited in being able to do so.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we actually just crossed the 70-year anniversary a few months back of the creation of Japan's so-called self-defense force. And it's really stunning to see just how far this military machine has come since its creation. So just after World War II, as you said, Japan had no military of any kind. The U.S. and other allied powers had stripped them of all that and occupied Japan. They enshrined pacifist restrictions into their constitution. But then it was in 1950, just about 5 years after the war had ended, that the Korean War was raging. And the United States needed to take its soldiers in Japan and move them to Korea. So the U.S. asked Japan to organize what they called a national police force. That was a force of just 74,000 men that were mainly intended to just take the place of those U.S. troops that needed to be moved to Korea. So Japan formed this small police force. About 5 years later, it renamed it the Ground Self-Defense Force. And from there, the size just kind of started growing. Just sort of gradually growing, and soon they were regularly taking part in joint military drills with U.S. forces. And then in the 1990s, this Japanese force kept on steadily growing, and it was also becoming a well-armed, very flexible, robust force capable of amphibious operations. And that's huge for Japan with its 6,800 islands. And then finally in the 2000s, this self-defense force became what we see today, this fully integrated, ultra-modern assemblage of land, sea, and air components. It has 250,000 troops, and it's believed to be able to rival the military of most any other world power. Most rankings today put Japan at number 4 on the list, just after the U.S., Russia, and China, and just above India. So it has come just quite a long way, and when you consider how powerful it already is, then you see that this new radical spending increase that was just approved will be a dramatic move.
Maybe you could just put this in context of Bible prophecy for us.
Yeah, this trend really takes on a lot of significance in that context because the Bible says that one of the main alliances in World War III will be a confederation of Asian nations, which the scriptures call the Kings of the East. And Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, the editor-in-chief of the Plain Truth News magazine, he said that based on his understanding of Bible prophecy, he believed that Japan would be a part of that Kings of the East bloc. And, you know, that was based largely on Ezekiel 38. That gives some ancient names for Japan in the context of that bloc. So when we keep those scriptures in mind and Bible passages about just how destructive the final world war will be, then I think it shows us why it is just so alarming today to see Japan drastically increasing its military spending and power.
We have an article on our website, Japan to Drastically Increase Defense Budget, that explains these latest figures that are coming out. But also, we have a trend article, Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism. You can find that on our trends page, and we'll also link to that in the show notes for today's program. Thank you, Jeremiah. To America now, for true believers of Dr. Anthony Fauci, this week had some disturbing revelations. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the front page of the National Review this morning was the headline was The Fall of St. Fauci, really highlighting that it has been a rough couple weeks for the good doctor. It was about 2 weeks ago exactly when he was being grilled by Congress over allegations that the government agency he heads, the National Institute for Health, had actually funded coronavirus research in Wuhan. And he was adamant during those hearings that no way, no how did did he or his institute or the government agency he's running have anything to do with dangerous bat virus research in a Chinese lab? Though, interestingly, right after that grilling, he told reporters afterwards that there may have been, in his words, a very minor collaboration as a part of a subcontract of a grant we had with some Chinese scientists. And in the weeks that have gone by since then, it's now become pretty pretty common knowledge that under Dr. Fauci's leadership, the National Institute of Health gave $3.7 million in funding to a New York-based nonprofit called EcoHealth Alliance. And then that alliance, with the approval of the National Health Institute, gave nearly $600,000 of that money to the Wuhan Institute of Virology for bat virus research. And it looks like Dr. Fauci knew about it the whole time. So it's like he definitely hasn't been telling the truth. Well, now he's starting to, under pressure, fess up to it. Even the Chinese state media is kind of turning on him and how Anthony Fauci is a sign of the moral decline in America, that he'd blame the Chinese for potentially leaking this coronavirus out to the world. I don't know if he actually said it as bluntly as the Chinese are saying he said it, but he's definitely looking at it as a possibility. It's like, yeah, that virus could have originated in the Wuhan Institute of Virology and leaked out, which is something that only Mike Pompeo and Donald Trump were saying at the time.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what the response to this is, because it seems like Dr. Fauci's reputation, there have been a lot of things that have undermined this kind of perception of him being irreproachable and saint-like over quite a long period. But there are real true believers out there who don't seem to be willing to abandon their lionization of this man. But this evidence that's coming out that is, it's more and more concerning that this could very well have been a direct attempt by China to manufacture a pandemic.
Right. That is interesting, because I saw, I forget what date the interview was given on, but Mr. Stephen Flair played it on the Trump Daily Radio Show yesterday, of his interview with Dr. Fauci and some member of Congress, where he's going on about how his work with some of these Chinese scientists, and this congressman was saying, he's like, so you trust the Chinese? He's like, well, he's like, the scientists were fine. It's like, I don't necessarily trust the Chinese Communist Party. And then the cross-examination was really revealing, where he's like, so you're thinking that the scientists in the Wuhan Institute of Virology aren't controlled by the Chinese Communist Party? And well, in the process of this cross-examination, the congressman, he did a really good job at revealing that, like, Dr. Fauci is either lying or the most naive man ever born to think that he can be working with these scientists doing bat research at the Chinese Institute of Virology, and they're all just interested in pure science for humanitarian reasons, and these scientists that live in a totalitarian communist regime aren't using the American taxpayer dollars that we're giving them for this research for something nefarious. Because if you look at the, forget the National Institute of Health, but like what the CIA or some of these other groups are reports coming out with, they said it's pretty well known that China's, they're working on super soldier programs, trying to biometrically enhance human beings to fight wars more effectively, and even the potential of ethnically specific viruses, like viruses that could, for example, say target Caucasians but not Chinese. And so, because something like coronavirus, that's probably the best evidence that it wasn't a Chinese bioweapon, or at least it wasn't ready yet, is that it leaked out of Wuhan and it's killed just as many Chinese people as it's killed killed other people. But this idea that our intelligence agencies are telling us that you're looking at bioweapons that could target enemies of a specific race, I mean, that could make a war really devastating. And, I mean, who can say whether the Chinese will ever get far enough to realize a weapon like that, but there's definitely good evidence that that's their goal. And someone like Dr. Fauci running the Institute of Health, giving American taxpayer dollars for them to continue biological research is only going to help them make progress toward that goal that much faster.
Well, there's certainly a whole lot to look into, and one would hope that the full truth about this would come out. We do have a couple of articles up on the website that you can look at that at least raise more questions and concerns about what may have gone on here. What Andrew was just referencing there is dealt with in an article that he wrote that's up at thetrumpet.com right now. Why is China collecting American DNA? He talks about the super soldier program and how they're actually trying to bioengineer super soldiers. We also have an article that we spoke about on Wednesday's show with Mihailo Zekic. Did China prepare years ago to launch a pandemic? You can go check that out. We'll link to both of those in our show notes for today's program. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll talk to Mr. Noctegal about the death this week of someone he's worked closely with for several years now, Israeli archaeologist Dr. Ilat Mazar. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
This week, Dr. Ilat Mazar died, a woman we've had a close relationship with for many years, pursuing a mutual passion for Jerusalem archaeology. Mr. Stephen Fleury did a wonderful Trumpet Daily program about this on Wednesday. We now have the opportunity to hear about it from our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it was a very difficult Tuesday night to hear about Dr. Mazar's death. This is an individual that is really Jerusalem's archaeologist. She knows more about the excavations that have taken place in this city, the most critical ones over the past 50 years. She's been a part of a lot of those excavations, whether it's her grandfather, Dr. Benjamin Mazar, in the 70s. And then Yigal Shiloh, the excavator of Area G, of the upper parts of Hezekiah's tunnel, the way they get down to there. She was on those digs. And then her own digs in the City of David, where King David's palace was discovered, a little bit further north on the Ophel, where she's found things from King Solomon's time and the seal impressions of King Hezekiah. I think a lot of our listeners are aware of her exploits, but perhaps they might be unaware of how the archaeological world and specifically the Israeli archaeologists do look to her as being the authority on Jerusalem archaeology. She has excavated more than anyone else there, understands a great breadth of the depth of those excavations, not just hers, but other people's as well. And so at her funeral on Wednesday in the north of Israel, it was like a massive reunion, actually, with everybody that Dr. Mazar had worked with over the decades, and it was hard. Of those that have worked directly with her in excavations, Israeli archaeologists, they were sensing that, just like we are, I think, what's next? I mean, there is no other candidate out there, archaeologically speaking, that could pick up the baton and walk in Dr. Mazar's shoes without an extremely fast learning curve. And even then, there is no one really in the field that has the respect for the Bible that Dr. Mazar does. So she brought two things. She brought her passion and zeal with a work ethic that I've never witnessed with anyone else, but then also being fearless in the desire to use the Bible as a text, the best text to understand what comes out of the ground in Jerusalem. Nobody has the understanding of the Bible or the passion that she had. And so there is a bit of a dark cloud hanging over Jerusalem archaeology right now in terms of the Israeli archaeologists, because there is no one realistically that it seems could take over from her in this field in the city.
I want to get back to that point. First, I'd like to just ask you, if you wouldn't mind, just talking about your relationship with her. I was able to visit a couple of times, and I was really struck by just how loving she was toward the students that we sent over there. We had several groups of students, and just the personal relationship that she developed with our crew was really quite moving.
Yeah, it is. And this is talking to the brothers of Dr. Mazar, or the sons of Dr. Mazar. I think one's 29, maybe 26, and then perhaps 22, the three brothers, just yesterday. That was very evident from their discussion with me, how much she talked about all of our diggers, all of the students, and maintained contact with them. I mean, there's a lot of people listening to this that have gone over to Jerusalem to dig that have regularly emailed her, Dr. Eilat Mazar, and she responds. And as it were, as her younger son told me yesterday, she doesn't respond unless she likes you. So so she's open to talk to anybody, but as far as like an ongoing conversation, that's from her heart. And I've certainly witnessed that. I came over here in 2006, so it's going on about 15 years now, and I intended to be over here for 3 months as a volunteer on a dig, as part of the first batch of Herbert W. Armstrong College students to go over reinvigorating this relationship with the Mazar family. And, you know, basically it was some visa trouble that kept me in the country along with Edwin Trables. And then kind of things snowballed for me personally, where I got to just be a part of the other digs of hers. And over time, over the past 15 years, the relationship has grown extremely strong. Not just with me and her, but also Mr. Gerald Flurry and her. He regularly met with her every time he visited Jerusalem. And that was the highlight often of his trips to Jerusalem, was to meet with her. She unveiled the Isaiah Bulla to him one of the first people. She told him of excavation licenses that came the day he arrived in Jerusalem back in 2000, and I think it was the end of 2017. And so she has a very loving relationship with our work. I will say that it will come as a shock to all of our members of the Philadelphia Church of God, the supporters of the trumpet, of her death. However, it was her decision to really try and keep that as minimal. It's just like her personality. She doesn't want to make a fuss. She doesn't want to make anyone to make a fuss over her. And yet she willingly makes a fuss over everybody else, even on a personal level. And so she did keep it extremely secret. It was very difficult for the family themselves, actually, because literally no one outside of the immediate family knew about her deteriorating condition, apart from a few of us in the church and Mr. Gerald Flurry. And then just her family until 2 days ago. And she works, the relationship between us and that family is very close, and we're just very blessed to have that close relationship with her. She does, and she has seen as our work and her work working together side by side, arm in arm, in it together. She's regularly said to me that she wouldn't have gone back to the field in 2018 without us being a part of her work. Because it was just getting very difficult for her. And in hindsight now, it seems that she probably had this health condition back in 2018 when we funded the excavation up on the Ophel. And so, yeah, I mean, I think of her as a mother personally. Her brothers think of me as a brother. Her sons think of me as a brother. And her sister, Tali, we've had a really strong relationship with her as well. And she's an archaeologist in her own right, actually. She's not of the same caliber, but she's worked with Dr. Mazar quite a lot. She's a master's, I think, in archaeology. She actually went to Ambassador College for a year or so in Brickett Wood as well. So her relationship with the church personally goes back for a long time. And in our conversations yesterday, I mean, it was the Shiva, which is a week of morning, basically, when people visit the house and talk to the family. Just with her conversations with me yesterday, she is really desirous to not see any diminishment in our relationship between the Mazar family that is ongoing and the work of the college, Herbert W. Armstrong College as well. So it's hard to know where things are going to go from her because Dr. Eilat Mazar, she's irreplaceable as an individual. However, there's a great desire on behalf of that family to continue to uphold her legacy and for us to be there holding up that legacy also.
And there's a lot more work to be done over there. It just seems like there are many unanswered questions, artifacts that remain to be discovered, portions of the city of David that remain unexcavated. We've been talking about wanting to revive a large-scale dig over there for quite some time. I realize things are at very early stages at this point. Any sense of where some of those projects may go in her absence?
Well, I do know that Dr. Mazar, before she did die, did tell the relevant parties, be it in the city of David or even the head of the department of Hebrew University, that she was very much wanting and desirous for us to be involved, continue to be involved in these excavations. And even the city of David, head of the city of David, has talked about that as well. There is lots to be discovered. Lots of work needs to be done. That work will continue. And as far as from my vantage point right now, it looks like we will be a part of it.
Well, we appreciate your personal insights there. And it really was, I guess, shocking to those of us who weren't as aware of just how dire her situation was. But we definitely look forward to seeing how that situation develops going forward, and that her legacy is perpetuated. We thank you very much for your time there, Brent. The Asian nation of Sri Lanka has an extremely impressive port that is being branded as a showpiece city to the rest of the world. There's something concerning behind this project, and it was highlighted in a bill passed this week by the Sri Lankan government. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, for the last 7 years or so in Sri Lanka, they've been investing all kinds of resources into building this new city that you mentioned. It's off the nation's west coast. It's called Colombo Port City. And the first step was to reclaim about 660 acres of land from the ocean. So just an immense feat of engineering there that adds a sizable chunk to Sri Lanka's territory. And so the land reclamation is now finished, and the construction of the city itself is well underway. And when it's complete, it will be a metropolis of just stunning skyscrapers, but also all kinds of waterways and bike lanes and green roofs everywhere. It's all built around a sizable park in the city center. So just a really big emphasis on sustainability and on, you know, blending futuristic technology with nature. It's being called the next Dubai. So it all sounds very impressive, but there is a big problem. And that is that on Tuesday, Sri Lanka's parliament passed the Colombo Port City Economic Commission Bill. And this legislation makes it essentially a de facto colony of China. The bill turns the new city into a special international economic zone, and it's being done in a way that China has apparently planned for and pushed for since the beginning. And the passing of this bill should really come as no surprise, because Colombo Port City was a Chinese idea from the beginning, and it was built mainly with Chinese cash. It all happened as part of China's Belt and Road Initiative. That's the project designed to just bind the world to China by building networks of roads and railways and ports in nations across Asia and the Middle East and Africa and Europe. And we've talked on the show several times about how Sri Lanka was one of the most eager countries to sign up for the Belt and Road, and how it ended up not being able to pay for another port that China built for it. That's the Hambantota port on the southern coast. And with Hambantota, the Sri Lankans ended up having to sign it over to official Chinese control. So it was very alarming, but now the same thing's happening, though in a more subtle manner so far, with Colombo Port City. But I'll just read a quote here from World is One News. They wrote, "China has already pumped millions into the project. They reclaimed the land and built the high-rises. So expecting them to give up control is futile. Beijing is not looking for a partnership in Sri Lanka. Instead, it wants an overseas province. It began with the Hambantota port and has now spilled into the port city of Colombo." And then one final sentence here says, "Sri Lanka is on a highway to becoming a Chinese colony." So just a very worrying development for Sri Lanka, and really for anyone concerned about just how pernicious China's international power is becoming.
Sri Lanka and this port, this whole territory was once under British rule. And when you look at this from the standpoint both of history and prophecy, transfer of power from Britain to China. First of all, it's a pattern that we've seen elsewhere, and it's also very concerning from a prophetic standpoint.
It is, yes. For a number of years, the peoples of Britain and America had control over virtually every important oceanic choke point and sea gate on the planet. Locations like the Suez Canal, Panama Canal, Quebec City, Hong Kong, the Cape of Good Hope. You know, the list just goes on. And as you said, that list includes Sri Lanka. It was back in 1795 that Britain took control of Sri Lanka's Trincomalee from the Netherlands, who had it before then. And the U.S. and Britain coming to control all these maritime choke points was actually prophesied in the Bible, as you said. Genesis 22:17 said that some of the descendants of Abraham would come to control the gates of their enemies. And then other passages show that these descendants would specifically be Ephraim and Manasseh, which today are Britain and America. So that prophecy was fulfilled spectacularly with Sri Lanka and those dozens of other locations that really allowed them to control oceanic trade. But then there's another prophecy saying that if the U.S. and the U.K. did not turn to God, then they would lose control over those same locations. That's in Deuteronomy 28. And much of that has also been fulfilled since the end of World War II. You know, we've seen the U.S. and Britain lose almost all of those locations, including Sri Lanka, back in 1957. That's when London relinquished control of the port of Trincomalee to a newly independent Sri Lanka. And in the years since then, especially just in the last decade or so, Sri Lanka has moved more and more into the Chinese camp. So it's really a place where we can see, just like with Hong Kong, where we can see another sea gate that is not just being taken away from the UK, but is actually in the hands of one of its main rivals, China. And we have an article that we'll link to in our show notes. It's called Besieged in Thy Gates. It's by our own Andrew Miller and also Mr. Robert Morley. And it's got a whole section in there about Sri Lanka. And it really takes some time to examine those Bible prophecies and put these current events in the context of them. So I would recommend that to anyone who wants to better understand this.
All right. Thank you, Jeremiah. More evidence of Europe's tendencies to bully appeared this week in dealings with Switzerland. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this has kind of been this ongoing saga with the European Union that really, I think, exposes its character. So Switzerland is a country that's kind of semi-detached from the European Union. If you're traveling into Switzerland from France or Austria, you don't need to have a passport check. It's fairly easy to move there. They're part of a lot of different EU schemes, but they're not an EU member. They kind of have this semi-detached relationship. And that has been fine for quite a long time, but Europe is kind of saying enough, no more. If you're going to have these relationships with us, we want much more control. So over the last 10 years or so, the EU has been really putting the pressure on Switzerland to try and get them to agree to the same kind of deal that Britain walked away from over the last couple of years, where they would have to submit to the European Court of Justice and where they would sign up to what's called dynamic alignment, which is basically just they agree to follow EU rules now, and they also agree to follow whatever the EU changes those rules to in the future. So it sounds like this kind of technical buzzword. The reality is submitting to EU rule. Okay, whatever you say from here on out, we'll do it. And Switzerland is a country that's governed very much by direct democracy. For big changes, they need referendums or referenda. And I think although a lot of Swiss elite would have been happy to go along with this, they knew they could never get this through through referenda. So this has been going on for quite some time. And it's been 7 years of different tough negotiation. And then at this point, they just finally walked away. They said, no, you know, our people are never going to agree to this. You know, no deal. And so now what it looks like is going to happen is they're going to kind of have the squeeze placed on them. So they have 120 different, their relationship with the EU is defined by 120 different treaties that they've signed. One by one, these treaties are going to drop. It already began a bit where a treaty on medical devices expired. So high-tech medical devices made in Switzerland couldn't have the same level of free access to the European Union. They're talking about energy links now, and Europe's kind of saying, well, we might cut off our electricity exports to you or something like that, as they just ramp up the pressure as each of these 120 deals expire. It's not necessarily going to be an easy process. You know, the EU has ways to strike at Switzerland. Switzerland has ways to kind of strike back. But still, it is, like you said in that setup at the start, it really exposes Europe, where some years ago, I think it was Jean-Claude Juncker said, well, we just can't tolerate having this little white spot on the map. We want Switzerland. And you see that with the way that they're approaching this country.
Well, Richard actually wrote about this subject a couple of years ago, July of 2019, Switzerland under siege, the EU's desire to dominate exposed, and we see this being ramped up. But I would recommend going back and looking at that article from Richard that shows just how these events really do expose the EU's character, as he said. We'll link to that article in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much, Richard. U.S. President Joe Biden just unveiled the government's new budget yesterday, and it is a whopper. For this, we will turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is the biggest budget that's ever been proposed. It's $6 trillion, so that's about $200 billion more than last year's outlays. Last year, I think the U.S. government spent about $5.8 trillion, and so there was some hope, probably misplaced hope, definitely misplaced hope, that now that they don't have as many COVID relief packages, that this budget would be back till normal. But it looks like there might still be some COVID relief. But they said the two big drivers for this were the infrastructure bill, and then some also major expansions to the social safety net, which have basically taken up all the slack that the lack of so many COVID relief bills have caused, and that not only forced America to put forth another budget just as big as last year's, but actually about 3% bigger than last year's. The details of that budget will be coming out, I believe, later today. But I've seen other reports that it has some like long-term projections in there. We're talking about that we could be seeing like $8 trillion budgets by the end of the decade. So there definitely shows that there's not going to be a concerted effort to pay back all the debt we took on for the COVID relief packages, but instead, the U.S. government's going to be doubling down, going even deeper into debt, spending even bigger budget packages.
Why is this so concerning, Andrew?
Well, yeah, there's actually, let's see if I had his name, but there was one that was like a billionaire hedge investor that's been warning for a little bit that, in his estimation, the dollar will no longer be the world's reserve currency in 15 years. There's others who'd put that timetable quite a bit, bit faster. And largely just because of the debt. Now, like I said, when you're spending $6 trillion budgets and then anticipating spending $8 trillion budgets, but we're probably going to collect less than $4 trillion in taxes this year, you're having huge, almost $2 trillion deficits. And like, well, what do you pay for that for? It's like, well, you either borrow it from another nation or you print it. And it seems like more and more as other nations get skeptical of America's ability to repay, you're turning more and more to the printing option. That's why inflation's such a problem right now. But then as you inflate your currency, I mean, nations use your currency as a reserve currency because they think it's stable. When they're going through high levels of inflation, it's not stable anymore. They buy gold or euros or some other option.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese cryptocurrency, and then once you're no longer the reserve currency, you get like in a death spiral where now, if America's running $8 trillion budgets, they don't have two options to either borrow it or print it anymore. They have to print it because no one will lend to them because their currency is rubbish, and eventually it just over time, it gets to the point where the dollar just has no purchasing power and no one anywhere in the world wants to use it.
Where would you send people for more information?
Yeah, I'd go to our He Was Right booklet. There's a chapter in there on our financial 9/11 was prophesied that talks a lot about just linking Bible prophecies about America's downfall to the just statistical reality of America's collapsing economy and showing that once the economy collapses, it's just that much easier for all those other prophecies about besiegement and invasion to take place.
All right, thank you. You can also look at our new Trumpet edition, the July edition, an article by Robert Morley, What Does Free Money Cost?, and our infographic about just how much inflation is hurting the value of the dollar and how it's hurt many other currencies over history. Go check that out. What Does Free Money Cost? We'll link to that and that our financial 9/11 was prophesied in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Edward Abbey, "The fear of death follows from the fear of life. One who lives life fully is prepared to die at any time." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.